That's Gay Panic on 2SER 107.3. See you there.
An offence which has been on the rise and has cost Australians up to $1 billion.
Most people sort of fantasise about flying. Most people think about it. So rather than just thinking about it, we do it.
I've been stopped on the street and spat on.
How many pages do I have to do and how much have I done so far? And I've only done like
1%. And bang, it was in like a split second. I had no time to react. I was on the ground.
Because the reason why this is even occurring is...
Good evening and welcome to Razor's Edge. My name is Jesse Begley and you're on 2SER 107.3, Sydney's best community radio station. For the next half an hour, we'll be bringing you current affairs stories from all over New South Wales, everything from headline news to important grassroots information that affects you. Earlier today, I spoke to Chris Preston, Secretary of Bus and Trams at the RTBU Union, about the privatisation of Sydney's inner west bus lines. We speak to Are You OK?, a group that's working to help connect people and prevent suicide. They're going to give us some hints on dealing with bullying and cyberbullying. Later in the show, we speak to Roxanne Moore from Amnesty International about the recent revelation over child sex abuse in the New South Wales Reby Juvenile Justice Centre. Let's go to our first story. Have you noticed any disruptions on your work commute over the past month? If your service wasn't running, it could have been because the Sydney bus drivers were striking in protest to the New South Wales government's announcement that they will be privatising scores of bus routes in Sydney's inner west. Over 12,000 drivers will be affected by the decision, and today I spoke with Chris Preston, Secretary of the Bus and Tram Union, about what the privatisation means for them, and also about what it means to the millions of Sydney-siders who use the Sydney State Transport Service every year. Chris Preston, why are the bus drivers around the city up in arms over the privatisation of the inner west bus lines?
Okay, the first thing is that in December last year, the then CEO of State Transit, Peter Rowley, sent a letter out to not only the 1,200 bus drivers and mechanics and office workers in Region 6, but the rest of the 2,500 operators of State Transit Sydney depots, a letter saying you've done well, you've met your KPIs, you're a little bit ahead of where you are. If you're prepared to enter into a restructure, which would see a reduction of 40% of salary people, if you do all that, come the 1st of July 2017, all 12 bus Sydney bus depots will have a 5-year government bus contract. So when Minister Constant came out on May the 15th and announced that he's going to privatise Region 6, to say that this was a shock and a betrayal of what these operators in Region 6 had expected is an understatement.
And how did the state government respond to the strikes that were held in the weeks following the announcement?
So the 24-hour strike, we were obviously pulled into the commission once they got aware of it. We were asked to not strike, which is an order. We were asked to then go back to work, which is another order. We tried to comply the best we could. When I say we the union, but the workers weren't going back for anybody. They were that angry, they were staying out and strike. As a result of the 24-hour strike, which was Region 6 and Region 6 only, the rest of the network, well, I'll take a step back. As a result of that strike in Region 6, Minister Constance then came out and said on the 18th that the Cabinet can rip up contracts whenever they like. So that was the first thing. He's not assuring that the other three regions will have a bus contracts as well. But he then, if we weren't sure about what he was saying, he then went a step further 2 more times and said that he hasn't ruled anything out in further privatisation of the other three regions. Then the Minister, Premier, Jacqueline, come out and said the same thing, that she's not ruling anything in or out when it comes to further privatisation. So if they were worried about the 24-hour strike, they didn't show it with their comments. They then, because of their comments, got everybody else concerned, and that's ended up with a fare free day, which was across the whole public bus network. On the 1st of June, sorry.
And who will benefit from this privatisation? As customers, will we see any improvement in service or lower fares?
No, customers aren't going to benefit. You won't see lower fares. You see what's going on now with the debacle over just the last day or so over the train fares potentially going up because electricity's going up. Now, the privates have to make a profit. That's how private companies work. So if they're not making a profit, they will have to cut the cost of their operations. First things that you see go is a lot of late night services or underutilized services or non-profitable services. Late night services will be reduced. Weekend work, especially on a Sunday, will be reduced, if not eliminated. And you know, people don't have to believe the union because we're going to say this, but you speak to passengers who live in that's serviced by a private bus company, so they'll tell you, they're the ones telling us, there's no buses on a Sunday, there's very little buses after 9 o'clock, 10 o'clock at night. So these are the young people are going to suffer. They won't be able to get home by bus as they'd like to, or even these days go out, because they go out a bit later as they would. Weekend services will be reduced. Maintenance definitely gets cut corners. We know that. We've got bus drivers who used to work for us who go and work for private operators who ring up and tell us the types of buses and faulty buses they're expected to drive that we won't happen. So, you know, there will be a reduction in services, no doubt, especially in the non-profitable ones.
Will the state government have any accountability after this switch to the private sector?
Oh, the state government say that they're still going to regulate the fares and they still regulate the timetables. And that might be when you're only privatising one sector at a time. But if you end up privatising the whole bus network, which is on the cards, they haven't said it isn't, once that is privatised, there's no public involvement whatsoever, to think that the private people won't try to increase the fares, well, and won't try to do that, you're having yourself on. They will do it. They will try. There will be no public sector to keep an eye on them or to keep a watch on them. So if the all public transport and buses in particular are privatised, then the fares will go up, no doubt.
Do you believe there is an alternative solution to the issues pressing the state transport?
Absolutely. One of the first ones is to actually give realistic running times. So the government, for years, we've been trying, we've had disputes with them through state transit about having realistic running times. What I mean by that is they might give a trip 50 minutes, but that trip actually should have 55 minutes in it. They won't give you the extra 5 minutes, and they expect drivers to do it in 50. You physically can't. So if you fix the running times to realistic running times, well, then people will understand exactly how long a trip's going to take, and you will be able to get there on time. Secondly, you need to put infrastructure in place for buses to get around. There is no infrastructure. And what I would like to see in the way of infrastructure is on all the major arterial routes heading into the city, you need to have 24-hour bus lanes in and out on both sides of the road. That's, for the peak hour they go in, obviously, and then when they special out, they start another run in. So you need to make the infrastructure for the buses to get around the city. You need to put money into that. You need to put money into realistic running times. And if you do those two, and to collect revenue, you need to actually have revenue officers out there. If you do all those things, you're going to have improvement almost instantaneously. But this government has wiped their hands with it. They're going to give it to a private operator. They'll probably let the private operator have better running times and stuff that I've just described and say, look what a success this was. Well, the public sector buses could do it if the government gives us the same tools.
And a big thank you to Chris Preston from the RTBU Union for speaking to us earlier today. You're listening to Razor's Edge live on 107.3 FM and streaming online at 2ser.com. Don't go anywhere. We'll be hearing from Roxanne Moore from Amnesty International about the revelation that workers at a New South Wales Juvenile Justice Centre have just been charged with alleged child sex abuse. More with that after this.
What have you always wondered about Sydney and the people who call it home? 2SER is Seeking Sydney. Head over to 2SER.com and ask the questions you want our team to investigate. While you're there, why not vote for whichever question you'd like answered?
Stories, ideas, music. 2SER 107.3.
That's right, you're back on Razor's Edge with me, Jesse Begley. Now, this year, the Royal Commission into the Protection and Detention of Children in the Northern Territory revealed horrifying conditions and gross mistreatment of young people in the Northern Territory. Last year, the Independent Commission into Queensland Youth Detention Facilities was announced by the Attorney General over claims of abuse. It is in this climate that earlier this week, two justice officers were charged over horrific sex offences that allegedly took place between 1996 and 2004 at the New South Wales Reby Juvenile Justice Centre. Is it time for a royal commission in New South Wales? I spoke to Roxanne Moore from Amnesty International about it earlier. This week, two former justice officers working at the Reby Juvenile Centre between 1996 and 2004 were charged with sexual abuse. Roxanne Moore, what do you make of these charges? Do they come as a surprise to you?
It's beyond belief that in the third time for this week that we're actually seeing further allegations come out about abuse of children in detention across Australia. We had Cleveland in Queensland, of course, the Northern Territory Royal Commission, the allegations coming out of Bimbury in Canberra, and now these latest horrific allegations about sexual abuse of children coming out of Reby in New South Wales. This kind of child abuse happening in this very complicated power relationship between the juvenile detention officers and these vulnerable children is incredibly concerning. You know, sexual abuse is such a horrific violation of human rights, and for this to happen to very young children, as young as 10 years old, over such a long period of time, and not be uncovered and charges made until a royal commission uncovered that evidence, it just raises so many alarms. And while it's not surprising, given that other allegations of a sexual nature have been made in other youth detention centres that we've seen coming out of the Northern Territory Royal Commission and also an independent review in Queensland, it is, of course, showing that this is a national issue and it needs the Prime Minister's leadership. Each week we're hearing more and more allegations of just awful abuses happening to children in detention, whether it's being hooded and gassed in the Northern Territory or hogtied and sedated in Queensland, or a child having their neck fractured in Victoria, and now sexual abuse in New South Wales. This is a national issue. It's our national shame, and the Prime Minister has to take action before another child is abused in detention. The Prime Minister, like, how many more children have to suffer before the Prime Minister is going to take leadership to overhaul this injustice system? We need him to work in partnership with Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities to come up with a national plan of action, which is going to be about prevention and about supporting Indigenous children, families and communities to stay strong and stay together.
Would you like to see changes mainly made within the system, within the detention system, or outside of?
I think there's I think it's a bit of both. So, you know, from a human rights perspective, there is a culture of abuse and secrecy in youth detention centres across Australia, and this has to end. And it has to end now before another child is abused in detention under this government's watch. And Prime Minister Turnbull has to take that leadership and develop a national action plan to turn this around, have focusing on prevention rather than this tough-on-crime and brutalising children approach, which we know doesn't work. So you need to have rehabilitation in these centres. But you do also need to address the underlying issues which are leading children to become involved in the justice system in the first place. That's why it's important for government to start listening to communities about local solutions that's going to work for their kids, and supporting communities to put those things in place. So there's the prevention element, but then there's also looking after children who have been brutalised by this broken system and making sure that these abuses never happen again. I think in New South Wales, it's very important that these sexual assault allegations are looked at very seriously, and that the children who were involved in these horrific crimes have had the support that they need to recover from that. I mean, these are historic. They did happen some time ago, but the government has a duty to make sure that any child who's had their human rights abused in their care access to a remedy. It shouldn't take a royal commission for this evidence to come to light about what's happening behind bars to children under the government's watch. And this is not just limited to New South Wales. This is happening right around Australia. We're not hearing about these terrible abuses of children in detention until there's an independent review in Queensland, a royal commission in the Northern Territory, a royal commission here in New South Wales. And so that's not okay. It's not acceptable. There are a number of oversight bodies that are set up who are meant to report and monitor these situations, and they're failing. The system is broken. So we need this culture of abuse and secrecy about what's happening to children behind bars to end. And that's only going to happen if Prime Minister Turnbull takes national leadership on this issue, develops a national action plan which looks at supporting communities and families and ensuring that these kinds of horrific abuses never happen again.
A big thank you to Amnesty International and Roxanne Moore for speaking to us for that piece. Now, we heard about just before on the show, but I want to give you all, every listener, a reminder. Have you got a question about Sydney that's been bugging you? Then go online to 2SER.com and check out our Sydney Seeking Sydney application on your homepage. You can submit a question there and vote on a question you would like us to research this month. So get online, Sydney, and start seeking. Now let's go to our final story of the night. To get a better understanding of suicide prevention, Are You Okay and other organisations of the like are known to design targeted programs, educating the community on effective communication and socialisation. Are these cases preventable within the workplace, like rail and legal? Are those industries as much in schools and universities? Hyo Jin chats with Brendan Maher, the CEO for Are You OK organisations, to find out more.
If we take Are You OK's perspective, we are a health promotion, suicide prevention health promotion campaign, effectively. And we focus on not on the person who's struggling, but we focus on the people around the person who might be struggling. It's all about noticing changes in someone that you know. In a young person, perhaps someone that normally returns your calls or text messages isn't returning your calls or text messages anymore. Perhaps they're engaging in behaviour that it's just not like them. They're eating more than usual. They're not taking any pride in their appearance anymore. They seem more tired. They're quick to anger or irritable. Or it's about noticing differences with the person that you know and acting upon that difference and really finding an opportunity to sit down with that person and say, look, I notice you haven't quite been yourself lately. Is everything okay? And that's what Are You Okay at a whole of population level try to promote. It's about activating our sense of responsibility to act on the changes that we see in the people around us, and to reach out and sort of say, hey, look, I know you haven't quite been yourself lately. And then to know how to encourage action. So, to be able to point that person towards getting some extra help. In a school environment, it might be, look, have you thought about going to see the school counsellor? What can I do to help? How can we help lighten the load? The final fourth step in the Are You Okay conversation is checking in. Hopefully resolve that situation or get themselves to a better place. So those four steps are ask, listen, encourage action, and check in. It's not necessarily for mental health issues. You don't have to be mentally unwell someone doesn't have to be mentally unwell to be asked if they're okay. We all experience life's ups and downs, and when you're young, relationship breakdown, if you're at school, exam stress, bullying, sexuality, drugs and alcohol, loneliness, isolation, all the things that happen to us and test our resilience in life. And sometimes we could just be having a bad day, and most of the time we'll get through those bad days. But sometimes we're very good at masking the fact that we're really struggling with something. And, one of the greatest things that can happen is that someone actually notices and takes the time to, put their hand on your shoulder and says, look, mate, a bit worried about you. You haven't really been yourself. Is everything all right?
So there's the everyday resources where you've got a kit which is in context for the workplace or at school, university level, perhaps socially, and then also within law and rail.
People who work in the legal profession are at a higher risk than, say, some other professions. What we did was we had 18 law firms came together and said, we want to do something that's targeted specifically on people working in law, because we want to sort of start to try and go some way to change the culture, of our workplaces, so that people feel more comfortable to reach out and support someone that they're worried about in a profession where, in the profession, are terrified of showing any vulnerability and, because of a perceived weakness or, inability to cope with the high pressure of the legal profession. But we wanted to sort of break that open and say, actually, you're only really going to succeed if we nurture an environment where we can be better at supporting each other. That's what we did, and we got some amazing stories from within the legal profession, from people who talked about how conversations and how the support of their colleagues got them through those difficult times. Look, we are well empowered, we're well positioned to notice a change in someone that we work closely with. Sometimes that's very obvious if we know that a colleague has, lost someone close to them, a relative that died, or they've been physically unwell, or, there's a lot of things going on behind the scenes that, you wouldn't know about with the person sitting to the left and the right of you at work, or, the person you're working on a building site with, or whatever it is you do for a job. Now, a lot of people are fighting battles that you don't know about, but in a work environment, you really are well positioned to see if someone's not going so well. And it's about knowing the level of relationship that you've got with your colleague as to how far you can have a conversation. If you have a good relationship with them, it's really about finding an appropriate time to sit down with them at a peer-to-peer level, and just say, look, is everything going all right? It seems like you're under a bit of pressure at the moment. What can I do to help? Those conversations can be as personal as, I guess, you feel comfortable based on the kind of relationship that you have with that person. But, once again, it's about, taking our blinkers off and, not getting so stuck into our work that we don't take an interest in the people around us. And quite often, that starts at the very top of an organisation. So if you've got a CEO or a supervisor who really takes an interest in the team and takes interest in people personally, you're more likely to have a culture whereby, people stick together a bit more, and it's not just about work, it's actually about personal relationships as well as professional ones.
We were hoping to perhaps ask you if you had some interesting stats or comments that you could say for cyberbullying, or perhaps people affected by social media, especially the teens who may be device dependent.
I think with things like proliferation of social media, there seems to be a lot of activity happening now, particularly with schools around safety online, and there's a lot of policies and proactive frameworks in place for schools to much better manage the safety of their own students online. And I think as rough a stick as the social media does get in some quarters, I think it's also, it's also can be a really good force for good, in keeping people connected. I mean, we often advocate that there's nothing, better than, kind of a face-to-face conversation or, human contact and human interaction. But this is where young people are, and this is where young people are playing, and we need to be vigilant about how we can safety scaffolding as much as we can around these social media avenues for young people as well, so that without being, big brother, how to keep young people safe. Look, I think the important thing to explain that there are some fantastic low or no cost community services out there and help seeking services for young people. So there are certainly some audiences and groups of people that are at higher risk. You want to make sure that any approach to suicide prevention, and please bear in mind that Are You OK is only a tiny little part of some, pretty incredible work being done in suicide prevention. We are very much at the informal peer-to-peer support end, and we're a tiny piece of a much bigger picture. So, look, I would just say, you know, we're all it's a tough area. It is, you know, it's a challenging thing to talk about. You know, we're getting a lot better at it, you know, in terms of, you know, actually being able to talk about things like suicide prevention and if we experience an episode of mental health, or we have a family member who is struggling and not doing so well, it can be really scary. And trying to find the right mix of, you know, kind of information services, psychologist who works for you. But it doesn't mean you should give up.
And thank you to Brendan Maher, CEO from Are You OK organization. And you can take a look at the $1 million challenge and resource kits on their website. I'm Jesse Begley, and a big thanks to Razor's Edge producers Hyojin Shim and Ellie Madrich for getting us these intriguing stories. That brings us to the end of this edition of Razor's Edge, 2SER's home for New South Wales news. We'll be back next week at 7:30, Thursday evenings, with stories big and small. We tweet and we tweet all our podcasts, and all our stories are during and are available on our website at 2SER.com. So check out our past stories and some of the amazing content made here at 2SER. Don't go anywhere, though, because Static is up next with 2 hours of awesome new music for you. To take us out, let's play a song from our feature album of the week. This song's called Sahara. It's featuring Iggy Pop by artist Songhoi Blues off their album Resistance. Have a good night, 2SER listeners.